Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, the radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You'll be placed in a queue, and Jillian will speak to you. Also, feel free to log in the chat room and pose a question there. A few months ago, we had Charletta Evans as a guest on the show. She's a mother whose 3-year-old son was killed in a drive-by shooting. She shared that several years after her son's death, she received a letter from the teenager who fired the gun that killed her son. He was 14 years old at the time of the shooting, and she decided to go through a process called restorative justice. That experience changed her perspective on harsh sentences for youth. She is now an advocate for juvenile justice reform and has since formed a close relationship with the individual that caused her harm. On this episode of Spotlight on Youth, we're going to delve deeper into restorative justice, which may be referred to as RJ on the show, and how it's being used in community schools and juvenile justice systems to prevent system involvement and provide more meaningful responses when a crime has been committed. It really is a paradigm shift. Many would say it's born from indigenous ideas of conflict resolution and community healing. Restorative justice views crime as a violation of people and relationships. It's an approach that seeks to determine who's been hurt, what their needs are, and how these needs can be addressed. It uses processes that are collaborative and inclusive. And our guest today will discuss restorative justice and highlight several models that have been successfully implemented. Today we have Sujatha Baliga, who is an Associate Director of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, NCCD, and the Director of the Restorative Justice Project. As a former victims advocate and public defender, Sujatha was awarded a Soros Justice Fellowship in 2008, which she used to spearhead a successful restorative juvenile diversion program in Alameda County, California. She has served as a consultant to the Stanford Criminal Justice Center, has taught restorative justice to undergraduates and law students, and is a frequent guest lecturer at academic institutions and conferences. As director of NCCD's Restorative Justice Project, Sujatha assists communities in implementing restorative justice alternatives to juvenile detention and zero-tolerance school discipline policies. She also provides technical assistance to the U.S. Attorney General's Task Force on Childhood Exposure to Violence. Dr. Lauren Abramson is the founder and executive director of the Community Conferencing Center in Baltimore, Maryland, and a part-time assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She is a psychologist who has worked with children and families and communities for the past 25 years. The work of the Community Conferencing Center is groundbreaking for its multi-sector use of conferencing in highly distressed urban communities. Lauren advances conferencing as a means of building social capital and collective efficacy on many levels. And today also joining us for a short portion of this show is Cheryl Graves, who is the Executive Director of the Community Justice for Youth Institute. The mission of the Community Justice for Youth Institute is to build community capacity to resolve youth crime and conflict through restorative justice training, technical assistance, and advocacy. As a former clinical law professor at the Northwestern University School of Law, Children and Family Justice Center, Cheryl has more than 10 years of experience implementing restorative justice practices and providing training and support to community, schools, and juvenile justice providers. In 2005, she was awarded a Soros Senior Justice Fellowship to establish restorative justice practices in communities of color. She has traveled throughout the United States, Africa, and Brazil to share RJ models with non-governmental organizations, juvenile justice professionals, and political leaders. So I would like to welcome the three of you to the show.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Sujatha, maybe you can do an introduction of restorative justice before we hear from the three of you and what you've been working on. I did a very brief background, but what can you tell our listeners more about it?
Well, you did a great job, Lauren. And it is true that, you know, a lot of the wisdom that we work with in the restorative justice movement does come from indigenous roots, and particularly some of the models that all three of us are working with, sort of family group conferencing, which comes both from New Zealand and Australia, has indigenous roots in the Maori people of New Zealand, and then you know, peacemaking circles are something that we've learned from the indigenous people of this land. And there have been significant modifications that have been made in both of these sort of secularizing and making it appropriate for the communities that we work with. So I think that's sort of some of the, but it's always, I think, really important to pay homage to and give our respects to the indigenous folks from whom we're so grateful to have received a lot of the wisdom and the work that we do. I think the popularization of restorative justice here in North America comes a lot from Mennonite folks who in the 1970s started to develop models that are used here. A lot of people give credit to this wonderful man, Mark Yancey, who's in Canada, who was a probation officer, who had seen a lot of sort of the same kids going through the system over and over again and had the idea to basically take kids around door-to-door who had committed some serious vandalism in a small community to apologize directly to their crime victims and ask what they could do to repair the harm. And sort of people sometimes say that's sort of the start of the restorative justice sort of movement in the United States here. Basically, the theory of it is what you had said. Rather than asking sort of the questions of what law was broken, who broke it, and how do we punish them, or in the school discipline context, sort of what rule was broken, who broke it, and what's the appropriate punishment or sanction. Restorative justice, the paradigm shift that it calls us to, is a different set of questions. It starts with the person harmed or the people harmed or everyone harmed, really. Who's been harmed? What do they need? And whose obligation is it to meet those needs? So that's quite a shift in our thinking away from a more punitive approach to a problem-solving approach. And it is we're seeing it in schools and juvenile justice and adult criminal legal systems, our juvenile legal systems. We're seeing ways in which we can intersect with those pre-existing systems, but also operate sort of in tandem to or entirely external to those systems, from pre-charge through post-release, in lieu of school discipline. There are so many different models and approaches that can be used, but that's sort of a broad sweep. And I'd love to have thoughts from Lauren and Cheryl too. On this question because it's an important one. Maybe
so
I'll kick it to Lauren next. Yeah, go ahead, Lauren.
This is Lauren, and there's not a lot to add because it was so really thorough. I think that one of the things, since we're using a conferencing model which was adapted from New Zealand and from family group conferencing, just so people are aware of what the family group means, for the Maori in New Zealand, your family group are the people in your life who you care about and who care about you. And the way this approach developed was that when something went awry, in the Maori culture, they'd pull together everybody who was involved in and affected by the incident and their family group members. So you'd have the person who caused the harm and their respective family group members and the people or person who's been harmed and their respective family group members. So you're really widening the circle of who's involved in deciding, you know, what can be done to make this situation better, how to get some healing and how to get some learning around it.
Right. Cheryl?
Just briefly, one of the things that we've seen is that having started focused solely on the juvenile justice system and then moving into schools as the main feeder into the juvenile justice system and then beginning to recognize that the practices were not just applicable or useful in terms of conflict and crime, but very much in terms of both relationship building and community building and healing. And so I think that we started out with one frame and then very quickly through the community's insistence widened it to include a much broader frame that really touched the lives of the people impacted I think, in a much more critical way. So the sort of justice tends to speak, we tend to think of it specifically around crimes and conflict, but it's very much used in many, many places to build community, to build relationships that then can prevent crimes and conflict.
Well, just building off of that question, What are the values and sort of maybe principles that underlie, I think if we could talk a little bit more about that, the three of you, that fosters the relationship building in the community and then also transfers, you know, into the system setting. But also, I mean, Cheryl, you're talking about the impact already. I'd like to hear if there has been any research that you could share with our listeners about the effectiveness before we turn to what led to each of you, you know, to this practice.
Well, I can speak specifically to some of the results that have, or the outcomes that we've had locally. I know Sujatha and Lauren are probably very much steeped in the research, so I'll leave that to them. But just for example, we have had a lot. Everybody knows there's been lots of violence in both the schools and the communities in Chicago, particularly on the south and west sides of the city, and a lot of people very often refer to youth killed as students, and a lot of the violence has happened in and around schools. But what we found is that instead of sort of upping the ante and pushing kids out of school or dealing with zero tolerance processes, we've had principals and school administrators to invite many of us in to do healing circles, and not just with the students. Harper High School, which got a lot of press, in 2012 there were 28 students shot and 8 students killed in 1 year. And we did probably more healing circles than we did conflict circles because both students and staff were just traumatized with what was going on. And I remember one counselor saying, the least we should be able to do is keep them safe, and we can't even do that. You know, and so what Harper began to see then by use of restorative practices, including a lot of circle work, was not just the reduction of school infractions and sort of lessening of conflict, but they saw truancy rates go down, retention went up, academic achievement went up, as well as school involvement and parent engagement. And so part of it is very often those aren't the things that we measure, because we measure, okay, how many kids got suspended or arrested or expelled, when if we look at all the measures that are important with respect to young people and their success or just well-being, then we've had some pretty remarkable results from including restorative practices in schools.
And I think that I can, you know, dovetail on that in terms of the work that we've done in Baltimore, which maybe many of the listeners have seen the HBO series The Wire. Those are the same neighborhoods that we work in and that we've worked in for 15 years. And I refer to the work that we do as the flip side of The Wire, that, you know, when you were shaped by the institutions that govern us and when you change the institutions by asking different questions, like how Sujatha said, instead of asking who did it and how can we punish them, if you ask, okay, who's been affected and how can the harm be repaired and how can people move forward so this doesn't happen again? So we've had 15,000 people in Baltimore participate in a community conference, which we've used as a court diversion and an alternative to arrest for misdemeanor and felony offenses. Also in schools as an alternative to arrest and suspension, and in neighborhoods as an alternative to calling the police.
Mm-hmm.
And of the conferences that we've pulled together with those 15,000 people, 98% of the time, that group is able to come up with a written agreement that they decide themselves how they're going to figure out how to fix this. And there's been 95% compliance with those agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you asked also about really what are the values underlying this, and one of the values is believing that people really have the capacity to resolve some complicated things and some of these conflicts and crimes collectively themselves if we give them a good structure to do that. And I think that, you know, over the 15 years, we've shown 15,000 people have been able to do that. And there's such a strong community-building piece to it, because what's in these agreements, if you look on our website at communityconferencing.org, there's a video that shows one community conference around a neighborhood conflict where the neighbors had for 18 months called the police about kids playing in the street. And 44 people sat in a circle, and they figured out what they wanted to do, and they ended up, among other things, creating a football league that is run by 40 adult volunteers in that neighborhood. And that league just finished its 12th season, and it engages 100 kids every year. So there's that huge community building piece. And then we've also done what a lot of people like to look at is recidivism. And the reoffending rates are 60% lower than for comparable samples of kids who went through the juvenile justice system. And that's all done at about one-tenth the cost of what we currently do.
Lauren, I just want to add in.
Please.
I was going to say what you just said is really important, because it really is the part of the paradigm shift that I really appreciate is that it's not about the professionals taking over the reins and sort of dictating what the result has to be, because there's a very short list of options. It's about the people who've been impacted having a voice, both those who've been harmed and those who caused the harm, and sometimes those people have become interchangeable, right? But very much it's about them talking about their feelings and their needs, and then together coming up with something that addresses that. And I think about that when I was practicing law and representing young people, that what we told them when they stepped up was, be quiet, don't say anything except say not guilty. You know, and we'll take it from here. And that's ridiculous, but that's the system. And so that system really doesn't work for kids. It really doesn't work for most people. But it definitely doesn't work for young people and families who are trying to not just heal from harms or heal from injury, but are really trying to grow and you know, both a healthy family and a healthy community. So I just feel like the restorative approach just lends itself to so much more than could ever be possible through just the adversarial system.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to add a little bit on the data question as well, we are just starting to develop really robust studies right now. What we know from sort of more international studies is that there's significant recidivism reduction, cost saving, increased victim satisfaction, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and there's a pretty comprehensive study out there called Restorative Justice: The Evidence. And we are just starting to do that work here. I know that Spalding University in Kentucky is doing a really extensive study of a program in Louisville, Restorative Justice Louisville is a diversion program there that, again, a restorative conferencing program that looks like a really promising program there. Here in Oakland, the program that I helped start is just doing great as well, keeping kids out of the juvenile justice system for felonies and some high-level misdemeanors. And you know, the recidivism rates have been extremely low. Again, we're looking at about a 60% difference between crimes in the system if those juvenile offenses had gone through the traditional juvenile legal system. They would be looking at much, much higher recidivism rates, around 60% higher. So, and again, we need more robust studies. We need better studies here in the United States. And I think that that's one of the things that we sort of struggle with in all of our innovative work with young people and with anything that we do, is that we have these like 3-year grant cycles, and everybody wants to see that we're an evidence-based practice at the end of something, and there's very little funding for us to keep things going long enough. So a lot of promising programs have come and gone without us having been able to show exactly how effective they were, and being able to do comparative analysis with probation departments that sometimes don't even keep track of exactly what their recidivism rates are. So Those are challenging questions that we're hoping to dig into in the next 5 to 10 years, and really be able to come back and say, here's what we know. But preliminary data from every program I've looked at so far is super positive. And on the schools fronts as well, here in Oakland, Rita Alford, who works with the Restorative Justice Training Institute, had been an on-site restorative justice person at a place called Cole Middle School in Oakland, where they had one of the highest expulsion and suspension rates and astronomical rates of fighting on campus and teacher turnover because it was an extremely challenging place to teach. And, you know, in the first year that they took restorative justice to the kids, there was an 80% reduction in suspensions, zero expulsions, zero physical fighting on campus. And so we do see these success stories left and right, and I think it is really about handing the power back to communities, whether they're classroom communities or school communities or community members, getting involved and really helping young people stay the course and learn to do right by the folks that they've harmed. It's I just think that it is inherently far more effective than anything we're doing and anything I ever saw when I was practicing law as well.
And you modeled the program in Alameda. You did some study research from what they were doing in New Zealand, correct? And so I don't know if there's anything you want to say about that and how they have effectively used it in the juvenile justice system to basically eliminate locking up kids and things like that. And then I want to turn to Cheryl, who, you know, I know needs to get off soon the line, and I want to hear some of your stories, Cheryl, especially how you've applied this into the community in Chicago.
You know, so briefly, and there's much that can be read about it, I'd suggest a book called The Little Book of Family Group Conferencing New Zealand Style, which was written by Alan McRae and Howard Zare. Really gives a thorough background on the way in which the Maori people were extremely, you know, upset about the disproportionate rate at which their young people were being incarcerated and sort of lobbied for their indigenous ways of healing harm in their communities to be the way in which youth were handled when they did harm, and was so successful that it spread to a larger pilot that was outside the Maori community, and then to a national act which basically rewrote juvenile justice code to be restorative justice as the first approach. They've almost eradicated juvenile incarceration nationwide in New Zealand, and again, it's not there's been significant secularization or westernization of the model, and there's some critique around that. But it is basically the way in which youth crime is addressed, caused the juvenile detention facilities nationwide to be shut down. So, you know, we looked to that in creating the program here because we have obviously the same problem. Not obviously, it's unfortunately not obvious to everyone, but if you walk into juvenile hall in Alameda County, every single child's face in there is black or brown. And the rate of disproportionate minority confinement in all of our urban areas and in many non-urban areas is disproportionately youth of color. And so that was a part of why here in Oakland, in the organization I was working with at the time, Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, really dedicated to keeping disproportionate minority contact and confinement at the forefront of what we are trying to do with restorative justice here in the States.
Thank you. So, Cheryl, in sort of your remaining time with us, unless we can, you know, find a way to convince you to stay longer.
I wish.
I know, me too. Why don't you you talked about how you started off, you know, thinking you were going to apply it in one way, and now it's been applied more in a community-based way as well. So I don't know if you want to share how that's working in the Chicago area, maybe highlight what you're doing and some of the success outcomes that you have had and are promising.
Sure. I guess first I just want to backtrack to something Sujatha was saying, but also just really wanted to give credit to both Sujatha and to Lauren just for the really major push they've both been given in terms of staying the course with the work, really really trying to create good research and database work that we can all look to and speak about, because as Sujatha was saying, people are always saying, there's really not, it sounds like a good idea, but there's really, what's the evidence for it? And there is evidence, it's just that it doesn't always look like the evidence that that funders and other folks are looking for. But one of the things that Sujatha was talking about was some work that Rita Alford was doing in the Oakland schools. And I remember talking once to Rita, and this really impacted me because we were in Florida doing a training together, and one of the head honchos of the school district said, this is just really great because the first thing we're going to do is really begin to impact impact suspensions and detentions and hopefully reduce expulsions because that's the first order of business. And I'm nodding my head, yes, yes, that's right. And Rita's shaking her head, no, no, that's not right. And I said, okay, so what's the deal? And basically what she said was just so important to me and my growth. And she said, if you start with the kids and only the kids, and it's just about discipline, it's going to be limited to a very few number of young people. And they will learn about restorative practices, and they will benefit, and perhaps their families, and maybe some of the students that they were involved with, but nobody else in the school will probably even know the words, restorative practice, circles, conferencing, et cetera. If you start with the staff and you work with the teachers and help them to understand the significance, the relevance, you know, the application of the practices to both relationship building, to social-emotional learning, to some of the other really critical aspects of the student's learning experience, if it resonates with the teachers and they see it as being useful for them, they start doing their meetings that way, they start addressing some of their issues that way, so that they're actually now the people who've been impacted who are talking about their issues. Then when you begin to apply it to students, one, you don't get the pushback, but also it becomes more of this is how we want to engage across the board in our school. Because what we found in too many schools in Chicago and too much of our work feels like a setback because you start in a school, you start with the kids, things are moving along, principal's on board, and then the principal gets transferred or they leave. And then all of a sudden the new person that comes in is clueless, doesn't want to deal with it, it's not something they know, and so the school is back to square one. And one of the reasons why we decided that the community had to be at the center for the push for restorative justice, both in the schools and the courts, is because, and a good friend of mine, Shaka Baroff, calls it the youth and family hammer. Who are the people that are really impacted? You know, systems people, we're going to potentially come and go. But those people that live in the neighborhood, whose kids go to that school, whose young people are getting locked up, they're the ones that are there at the table and they can say, no, 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 no. You don't need to suspend my child. No, 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 no. Because what we do in this school is we'll call for a circle. Or there's a peer jury that operates. Or it did, and we want it back. And so part of it is really very much about putting power back into the hands the people who traditionally have been pretty powerless or felt that they were. One of the things, there are a number of things in Chicago, and I'll do it really quickly so I don't take up too much time, but one of the things that's really been wonderful is the parents' movement. You know, parents of third graders got really ticked off because 30-some-odd third graders got arrested and expelled from school in 1 week. And they're like, what? These are 8-year-olds. What are you talking about? And as it turned out, the principal, you know, it was some kind of melee in the lunchroom. People were throwing milk and oranges and apples, and all of a sudden that becomes an arrestable offense for some 8-year-old. So anyway, so the parents organized, and they developed into what they call Parents Organized to Win, Educate, and Renew, a policy action council. And they didn't just address the issues at their school, although what they were able to do was to set up a parents' speech room and then begin to do restorative practices. So the parents actually did those practices in the school, but they then organized parents around the city to speak to the legislature about the inclusion of restorative practices in schools. We've seen a lot of churches step up. We've organized and worked with a lot of people involved in churches because the idea is that if things can change at the neighborhood level, if things can change in the community, and the community can support the family, then we don't have to see so many of our kids, our black and brown kids, pushed into the system. And so that effort, it has a lot of growing momentum, and there are a lot of the numbers have really increased in terms of folks doing that. The latest thing that we've been working on is, well, actually for the past year and a half or 2 years, is something called Restorative Justice Hubs. We've been really trying to figure out how do we effectively address the incarceration rate and the detention rate of mostly black kids. There may be one or two white kids in detention, maybe about 18 or 19 Latinos. Everybody else is black. And that's not the way Cook County looks at all. And so, but the judges will say now, we're willing to divert kids, and the detention center will say, we're willing not to lock these kids up, but where do we send them? What do we do? And so there's a lot of capacity, particularly with sort of justice capacity that's been developing in the neighborhoods. And so we looked at the 10 most targeted, the 10 neighborhoods where most of the kids are being moved into the system, where there's the most violence, and began to identify organizations that are already working with gang-involved youth, court-involved youth, youth that other folks really just don't want to have anything to do with, and began to invite them in. And so sort of the thinking behind the RJ Hubs is first one of welcoming and hospitality. We welcome you. We are glad you're here. Most kids come because they know other kids that have been there. So it's a word of mouth thing a lot, but a lot of cases are also being referred from the courts. But it's about welcoming and hospitality. It's about building relationships with these young people through circle work and other kinds of restorative practices, mentoring, et cetera. And then it's something called accompaniment, so that the referrals that get made based upon what the young person and the mentor and the staff decide, so that the young person decides they really do want to get back into school, right? So, or they need mental health services, or they need some kind of other services. Generally, there would be a referral form given to the young person and or their parent, if there's a parent involved, and they would be referred off to that. Well, usually, I'd say 9 times out of 10, they don't get there. They don't get there because they go to knock on the door of the school and they've got a bad record and the school doesn't want them. But if you're accompanied by somebody from the neighborhood center who is in relationship with the people who run those services, then that is very, very different. And if they're going to walk with you that path, and even when you fall off that path, they're still going to be there for you, then that young person experiences a sense of belonging and purpose that they haven't necessarily experienced before. So it's the accompaniment piece, and then it's the relentless engagement with the resources, both in the neighborhood and throughout the city, but also advocacy around what's lacking. We had our mental health services sliced in half. So at the same time we're advocating to get kids back in the community, they cut most of the mental health services in the communities where the kids are. Anyway, so I don't want to keep going on, but just know that there is a lot of energy for this, both with some of the systems folks, but community is really, really stepping up. And so at this point we have two existing restorative justice hubs, and in fact, in one of the communities, all the kids on probation go through this one particular RJ hub in terms of diversion, for mentoring, for services, et cetera. And the judges and the police are now starting to begin to look to these hubs as having real capacity to address the needs of these kids and families that the court can't do. So let me stop rambling. I apologize. We love this stuff. We really do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cheryl, thanks for being on as long as you were. And, you know, it's up to you. I know you have to run. So
I do have to run, but I just really appreciate it. And I mean, basically, Sujatha and Lauren can tell it all because they're really doing some significant work both out in California and in Baltimore. And actually, it's had application in Chicago and throughout the nation. So thanks so much. I appreciate being able to be on with you all, and I look forward to another opportunity to do so. So thank you.
We appreciate you, Cheryl.
Okay. All right. Goodbye.
Bye. So, you know, Cheryl shared what's happening in her community. I'd like to hear from both of you as well. Everything I hear about is how transformational this is. And so personally, maybe how you've been transformed being part of this and what you've seen for communities, for those who've been harmed by crime, those who have harmed others. I think to hear stories and to actually also explain how the process worked really helps people have a better understanding. And before the two of you go, I just want to remind our listeners of the call-in number, which is 347-994-1149. You press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. And also feel free to pose some questions for our guests in the chat room. Okay. So I don't know which one of you would like to start.
Do you want to go first, Lauren?
I'll go. Sure. I mean, there's so many levels that I've been transformed personally, I think, and the transformation that we just see all the time here, and it's just been so heartening. I guess maybe I'd like to say something about how I got involved in doing this work, because it really has, for me, a lot to do with the transformational piece of it. I'm a psychologist, and my training was actually in neuroscience and animal behavior. And I was studying, for many years, I studied how emotions affect health and illness, and had worked for the last 2 years of his life with a really brilliant and much ignored psychologist named Sylvan Tompkins, who for decades has really been saying that what motivates us as human beings biologically are our emotions. That, you know, Darwin said we have our emotions, we're born with them, all mammals are born with them for really important survival reasons. You know, like anger motivates us to attack, and that helps us survive. And fear motivates us to get the heck out of there when we're in a dangerous situation. Interest is actually one of our positive emotions that motivates us to engage. You know, I feel like if we just had an education system that was based on maximizing the interest of students, we would have a completely different kind of education experience in this country. That, you know, interest is what motivates us to engage, and we just don't get kids interested as much. So what does this have to do with transformative and restorative justice? Well, when somebody's car is stolen, that makes a number of people really angry and really afraid and sometimes disgusted. And people have, you know, in the wake of crime, have all these negative emotions. And what community conferencing and what a lot of these restorative processes allow people to do is to be human and to be emotional. So people come to a community conference with all their rage and all their terror and all their disgust and whatever else they're feeling, and then they have a space where they can say how they feel about what happened. And they also have a space where they can listen to how other people feel about what happened. So that in that circle of 10 or 20 or even 30 people, you know, there's really a lot of emotion that's getting expressed, often a lot of negative emotion, which we usually, you know, in this culture, what do we tell people to do with their negative emotions? I mean, we tell them to put a lid on it, basically. And that gives us problems, that gives us gut problems, that gives us jaw problems. I mean, we suffer for having to put a lid on our emotional experiences all the time. And so what conferences do is let people express how they feel. And what we have seen in the process of doing that over and over and over again is that there's this shift, and that's the transformative piece. Because at some point, you know, somebody in that circle is going to say something that's going to make everybody think a little bit differently about what's going on. We had a case, it was sexual harassment in a middle school, and this is part of our video on the website also for the school case. And in a cafeteria line in the middle school, this boy took his friend's hand and put it on the breast of the girl in front of them. And they both, she ran out of the cafeteria hysterically screaming, and they both got suspended for 25 days immediately. Now, the father of the girl wanted these kids not only suspended, but he wanted them put in jail. He was so angry. He said he hadn't slept a full night's sleep in, I think, the 5 days since we had gotten the referral. But he agreed to try community conferencing. And so they're all sitting there, and the two boys start to tell the story about what happened. The instigator boy was really kind of slumped in his chair with his arms folded. The other boy was incredibly remorseful. And then they go around the circle, and the girl tells about how upset she was, and then the parents of the girls start to talk, and everybody starts saying how they were affected, and the boy who instigated is still slumped in his chair with his arms crossed. And the father says, after about 10 minutes of this, he says, you know, this is a waste of time. This kid isn't really getting it at all. We need to just, they really need to go to jail. And at that point, the boy's mother turned to everybody and said, he looks like this now, but when he's been at home, he's been crying about this. And at that point, everybody kind of realized, like, what do we tell our boys about how okay or not okay it is to, you know, to cry in public and to express vulnerable feelings? So they went around, and another minute goes by, and I turn, and he's still slumped in his chair, but this boy has tears streaming down his face. And, you know, you learn as a facilitator that silence is one of your best friends, really, and your most powerful tools. And we just sat there, and then the father, the girl, without any prompting, leaned forward to this boy and said, young man, you do not realize the impact of what you're doing, because if you keep this up, you're going to end up in jail, and I don't want that to happen to you because there are way too many African-American men in prison, and I want you to make the most of your life because I love you. So this was the guy who had wanted this kid to go to jail who's now telling him that he loves him, and now everybody in the circle has tears in their eyes. Mm-hmm. And at this point, that's what the transformation is about, because they went from being scared and angry all of a sudden to collectively feeling responsible for what's going on here. And so as a facilitator, I said, so what do you all want to do to move forward in a better way with this and to repair any harm that's happened? And the girl got some very sincere apologies from the boys. And the father said, you know, I think these boys should come back to this school, and their role should be to take care of and protect the girls in this school. And here's how I think they can do that. And they ended up doing that. This conference was in October, and that man who wanted those kids put in jail ended up visiting those kids every week for the rest of the year. So it's kind of a long story to say that the transformation that I think is happening is about who we are as human beings. It's emotionally, we make mistakes. We do things to hurt each other. And what restorative processes allow us to do is to be human, to show up, and to have the feelings that we have, even when they're negative. And what happens is that those negative emotions that generate conflict in and between us end up transforming into the positive emotions that really motivate us to cooperate with each other.
Well, it's a very powerful story that also not only shows change in the people who are part of that process, but long-term change and impact for the culture of what was happening in the school as well.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just to think a little bit about sort of what brought me. This is Sujata speaking. What brought me to restorative justice? I went to college and was very much interested in becoming a victim's advocate, and did that for a few years after college, and applied to law school thinking that I would be a prosecutor. But through some personal transformation sort of in my own heart towards my father, who had sexually abused me, and that anger that I carried towards my father was really the impetus for my wanting to be a prosecutor. I started to let go of my own anger, and I realized that's really what was fueling my work. and went to law school really confused about what I was going to do, and in the first couple weeks was convinced by my criminal law professor to not drop out, which is what I really wanted to do at that point, but to consider a career in defending women who kill their abusers or defend themselves against their abusers and then get charged with crime. And so I was encouraged basically to become a defense attorney, and at that point I hadn't really put the pieces together that I was going to have to, like, defend everybody. Not, you know, you don't just get to have this career where you just defend women who defend themselves or commit crimes out of a place of having been abused. And in that process, really learned a lot about folks who commit crimes and had my heart opened in a new direction. And at the same time, all my work on the criminal defense side and all my work in the victims advocacy side both felt incredibly deficient. This very binary way in which we approach harm in the United States and in any system that's really binary anywhere in the world is just incredibly deficient to me, in that it really creates a notion that there's a limited rights, a pie of sort of rights, and that it's limited, and, you know, where you're giving privacy rights to a defendant, you're taking away the right to know from a victim, and sort of every sort of confrontation in court really just kept this anger, animosity, my side versus your side thing alive, and that really just didn't sit right with my soul, but I couldn't really imagine a way that we might do things differently. I started reading about the Tibetan system of justice prior to Chinese occupation and was learning these incredible things about a codified system that valued a reconciliation or parties agreeing to the facts before entering the courthouse doors or notions of, like, non-finality, like if the harm isn't fully healed 5 years later, there's new facts that come up, you go back to court to sort things out. I saw a lot of beauty in that. My friend, Susan Marcus, who's an amazing capital litigator and brings a lot of wisdom about restorative justice to her work, said, you know, I've been telling you about this for years. It's called restorative justice. And so from that point, I just couldn't get enough. You know, I just started going to every training and every form of anything vaguely restorative justice that I could get my hands on. I felt very privileged to be able to have the time and the capacity to go to circle trainings with Kate Prannis and, you know, learn from Howard Zaire and just lots and lots of trainings, family group conferencing trainings and victim offender dialogue trainings with Lorraine Stutzman Amstutz. And I mean, just DEVO trainings, you know, defense-initiated victim outreach trainings with Kelly Branham. I mean, I just literally got the best of the best from so many different people. And there was a certain point at which I was representing somebody on appeal, and he had an open and shut case. I was still doing criminal defense work at this time, and he had an open and shut case, and in terms of being able to win on appeal, and I felt really certain that we were going to be able to win on appeal. And he had defended himself, basically, and the judge had excluded his testimony. The judge didn't let him testify about some basic facts that would have shown his innocence. And I knew that I could win this on appeal. Meanwhile, when I visited him in prison, I was working in New York at the time, he had this gorgeous apology letter that he wanted to send to the victims, and they were related to him. They were cousins. And it was stunning. I mean, the bottom line is he still did take somebody's life, even if it was in self-defense, and he carried this incredible moral burden around that, this young man who was 18 when he committed this crime, and he was looking at 20 or 25 years in prison. And I had to tell him, you need to tell your priest about that, you can tell me about that, but you need to tear that letter right up, because that's going to be, if you send that to them, that's going to be evidence of a guilty mind. Even though you're not really saying anything, that letter that incriminates you, and it's still sort of self-defense, you know, stuff that you're saying in that letter, that can be used against you. I'm going to win this appeal, and we're going to get you a new trial, and if they're still this angry, if this letter doesn't open their hearts in some way, that's evidence against you. And, you know, I really had to strongly advise him to never send that letter. And I literally watched the moral lights go out in his eyes that day. And I realized, like, I can't keep doing this. Like, this isn't – I both can't do anything that puts this young man at jeopardy for 20 years in prison for something he certainly shouldn't be spending that much time in prison for. And I can't I just can't let them, you know, I just couldn't continue to tell people that they can't say sorry for the stuff that they feel really bad about, right? So I wanted to figure out a way where we could have those necessary, and if all the family wanted from the transcript, from the sentencing, it was clear all they wanted to hear was, I'm sorry about my part in this, but there was just no way for that to happen. And that dissatisfaction that day sort of really led me to think, how can I do this? And so I came out here and I met Fania Davis, who works with Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, and we started to plot and scheme about how it is that we can build a restorative juvenile diversion program here that would and it's been fun because I get to still keep sort of my lawyer hat on to some. A lot of people who are lawyers who work in restorative justice say, you know, I'm a recovering lawyer, I'm a restored lawyer. And I very much think of myself as a restorative lawyer because I am very interested also in the questions of, as we grow these programs and we interface with pre-existing criminal legal systems and criminal, you know, and juvenile legal systems, school discipline, policy, law, What legal protections do we need to put into place to keep restorative justice restorative? How can we do things like have, you know, what I call the reverse Miranda rule, where it's sort of guaranteed that nothing you say can be used against you in a court of law? Can we create memorandum of understanding with district attorneys that allow our processes to operate sort of under a privilege of sorts? What kind of processes do we need to put in place to make sure that victims still have rights to victims' compensation if they opt out of the traditional or the current legal system? Like what kinds of things do we need to make sure that as we grow this and expand it, what are the education code timelines for expulsion? And can we have a unitary process when kids commit crimes on school campus? And I also just recently facilitated a sexual assault case with a kid who committed a sexual assault on campus, who is both going to be expelled and go through that whole process, and the victim had to go through that whole process and go through juvenile court, right? And just doing these two things would may come up with disparate outcomes and et cetera. What can we do to create a unitary restorative justice process that could meet both the school expulsion sort of process needs and the juvenile justice needs so that victims don't have to go through these things twice and young people don't get two different outcomes when they do harm? And that was an exceptionally successful conference. It was so beautiful. This young woman was deeply empowered by that process, and her mother can't say enough good stuff about who she feels her daughter became through the restorative justice process in terms of learning to say no means no and really and being able to look the person who harmed her in the eye and do that. It was, again, not a dry eye in the house and extremely powerful, and the young man really got it, and it really turned his life around, and just really beautiful processes. And you ask, how is it healing for me? I mean, as somebody who suffered sexual harm as a child, to get to watch a young woman receive what she needed from the young man who harmed her, I mean, it couldn't be more beautiful for me. And to imagine what that could have been like if that's something I could have received as a child is really just opens my heart and makes me just grateful that I get to do this work. I can't believe, as I say this every day, I cannot believe this is my job. Like, how can this be my job? So,
well, we have about 8 minutes left, if you can imagine. So clearly we need another hour or so to talk about this, but In our final minutes together, if you can each share maybe a few tips that you can think of to communities that may be thinking, well, this is maybe something I'd like to explore more, and maybe some common resistance that people think will be there that and how they can meet those challenges, and then any other sort of final thoughts you have about this.
Well, I mean, the great thing, I think, is that as this work grows, there's people like Cheryl and Sujata, and there's our group in Baltimore, and there's Kay Prantis. There's so many people around the country who they can tap into, so that at this point people don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so anybody who's interested in it, I really encourage people to reach out to, you know, I'm sure we'll be able to get people access to the resources so that you know, all of us have learned things that we have found is really helpful in engaging the systems to get them to be willing to do things in a different way. And I think what's been really encouraging for me is that, you know, we approach our, you know, our prosecutors or our judges or our juvenile justice system, and we really just ask the question, like, what isn't working for you right now? I mean, you're doing some things well and you're doing some things where you're experiencing challenges, and when you start to hear about what their challenges are, that so often there's a restorative practice that where you can offer them and show them how it can help meet their challenges so that it's, you know, responding to their frustrations as well. Because I don't, you know, at this point, I don't think it's really a, you know, people on both sides of the legislative aisles agree that our current criminal justice system isn't really working very well. So that's really not a case that you have to make. I think what we need to do is to really get people out there to demonstrate that we don't, you know, we have the social technologies to do this differently. What we don't have yet is the political will to do it.
I would just echo all of that. I mean, again, Lauren offers, you know, training and technical assistance. So do we, and so does Cheryl, and, you know, Kate Prantis. Again, Rita Alfred, can't say enough good stuff about her work, and many, many others who do great, great work. Eastern Mennonite University has the Summer Peacebuilding Institute. You can learn a lot there. One of the things that I think was really successful in the work that we did here in Alameda County was that we started both with a ground-up and a top-down simultaneous approach, where we got buy-in from the judiciary, the presiding juvenile judge of the juvenile division, sort of assembled this restorative justice, a juvenile justice task force, and we really brought everyone to the table and did deep community building about with all affected parties and brought people to the table who aren't often at the table together. The public defender and the district attorney sat next to each other at this thing, and it was beautiful. And, you know, just starting the work, and there's several jurisdictions that I'm helping now, and San Francisco, I think, also, that was initiated by the district attorney's office, and that work was really is starting this beautiful way, because we did focus groups with, like, parents of incarcerated kids and formerly incarcerated kids and kids who've been formerly incarcerated. We just, every youth-serving organization I could possibly make the time to meet with, et cetera, and really just building a collective understanding of what would an ideal restorative juvenile diversion program look like, and really being responsive to community in that. And how can we use those community resources, pre-existing community resources, of which there are so many in San Francisco, to dovetail with this program to meet young people's needs, right? Restorative justice often operates sort of in lieu of court, and can sort of become too judicial in a sense, or too, you know, if we don't really do that deep community building. And so I'm super excited about that particular project, the San Francisco one. I think in some ways, because of the resources in that city, we're getting to build it, and because primarily the district attorney is so progressive and really thoughtful about how to roll this out. I feel like we're kind of getting to do some gold standard work there, both on the research side and also on the implementation side. So that's exciting. Yeah, don't recreate the wheel. There's so many of us here to help you. We'd love to see folks grow the work. There's so many places where it could start, and we're super excited about all of each other's work and seeing you all build it out there in the world.
And I think maybe one cautionary thing that I know Sujata agrees with this, and we come up across this in a number of jurisdictions that want to start doing this work, is that initially people only want to take the most minor cases.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And use those, and so there's what that can lead to, aside from it not really utilizing the power of this process in its fullest, is that it results in net widening. You know, mm-hmm. It results in including more young people in the juvenile justice system that really shouldn't be there to begin with. Mm-hmm. So, like in our office, we call them the weenie cases. You know, these the kid did unlawfully propel his bicycle down the sidewalk. You know, we will not take a case like that because
right.
We don't think it should be in the system to begin with. And
that's right.
I guess that's, you know, when systems first think of diversion, I think they think of using it for the most minor cases. And I think if there's anything that I would caution people is to not do that.
Yeah, and to follow up with that too, just another caution, not to end on cautionary notes, but also just make sure that youth of color are getting this process. If you're doing it in a diverse community, make sure you're just
Absolutely.
Watch your stats and make sure that you're being thoughtful about if communities or systems are cherry picking. That's another thing. And another thing is really do make sure that the collateral consequences of participation can't come back to bite your participants. So make sure that nothing said can be used against youth in a court of law later. It's not fair to tell kids that restorative justice is confidential when it's actually not. So you need to do some legwork to make that happen. I think those are some of the most critical pieces in rolling things out.
Thank you. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you both for the work you do every day and also being on the show and sharing very personal stories. And thank you to Cheryl, again, who spent her time that she could and shared as much as she could in the time she had today. Some resources for the listeners. As you can hear, there's a lot of expertise out there for you to access. And National Council on Crime and Delinquency, their website is nccdglobal.org. Community Conferencing Center, which Lauren mentioned, is communityconferencing.org. And Community Justice for Youth Institute is cjyi.org. Our next show is going to examine how courts and judges can be front and center in an effort to reduce disparities in the juvenile justice system. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Thank you both so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was great to be with you all.
Mm-hmm. So take care, everyone, and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth.